Good morning, Kansas City. Welcome to Free Market Underground, where we bring you all things boom and bust on a weekly basis. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. Free Market Underground is produced every week by Mr. Martell Love, and the show is sponsored by Butler Lands and Wagler. Good morning, Mr. Martell Love.
Good morning, Mr. Chris Butler. How are you today?
I am good. Yourself?
Doing very, very well. I'm ready for the spring weather.
Yeah, and basketball continues. That's how it continues. It's spring.
Yes.
When you get towards the Final Four and the national championship game, that is how you know you're getting close.
And opening day is on Thursday.
That's true. Yes. That's the other telltale sign.
Oh, yeah. I'm excited about that.
I am, too. You know, it seems like the Royals were kind of written off early in the year, but they've made some moves here over the last 2 months to make you think, you know what, maybe they can contend.
Maybe they can, and they've been looking good here. I've been watching some spring training games, and they're looking like a legitimate team.
Yeah, they are. And by the way, when I say contend, I don't mean for the World Series championship, but for a playoff spot, right?
Yes.
Wild card.
For the division.
Yeah, or the division.
Yeah.
A lot of that depends on how these other teams look.
Cleveland's still tough.
Cleveland's still tough. Yeah. I think kind of the sexy pick is the Chicago White Sox.
Yeah.
What about Detroit?
You know, Detroit is they're projecting them to be at the bottom of the barrel this year.
Okay.
So.
Well, they did kind of wheel and deal their way to get there last year. But they should also be stronger in years to come because they picked up a lot of farm picks.
Yes. So they're rebuilding.
They are rebuilding. And they got rid of Justin Verlander.
Yeah.
And J.D. Martinez. You're right. Yeah, I'd forgotten about. And who was their first baseman?
Miguel Cabrera.
Yeah, is he still there?
He's still there, but he was hurt a lot last year. I think he'll be back this year, but I wouldn't be surprised if they dealt him halfway through the season.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, getting close to the trade deadline, I think he'd make some pretty good bargaining chips.
Also, I think if the Royals are not contending, don't be surprised if Moose is dealt, or any
Escobar.
Other big names. Yeah, mm-hmm. Escobar.
Although I doubt many would be interested in Escobar, but they could certainly do it. I'm just hoping Alex Gordon can turn it around this year, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I like really the guy.
I do, too.
That's a lot of money we're paying him.
It is.
For him to be batting 100.
Right.
Yeah, we can't have that.
No, we can't. And, you know, tell me what you think about this segue, Martell. Speaking of batting 100.
Yes.
we have some news on tariffs.
All right. That was great, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. It went over like a lead Zeppelin. Did not garner much appreciation globally, certainly not in global equity markets. Here's the deal. We already knew that Donald Trump was going to have a tariff plan to protect steel and aluminum. And quite honestly, anymore, if you look at steel stocks like U.S. Steel or something like that, and you see that, you know, it initially had this spurt at the beginning of the month of March, and now it's going down with everything else. It's because they kind of gutted the benefit to U.S. Steel with those steel and aluminum tariffs announced earlier in March. And now they've basically given everyone an exemption, I think, except for Japan. But everyone else that asked for an exemption got one, and China, of course, they're not exempted either. So on Thursday, President Trump, early in the morning, actually, it was announced, he didn't announce it, but it was announced that he would be talking on Thursday about another directed Chinese tariff, this time ostensibly to punish the Chinese for intellectual property theft. I don't think there is. Oh, there might be a few people in the world that would deny that China steals intellectual property, but those few people are Chinese and they're probably stealing intellectual property. Most people would agree that is going on. And it has cost, by some estimate, hundreds of billions of dollars to U.S. corporations. And I do not doubt that either. Honestly, when I heard that someone had figured out that it cost U.S. corporations a couple hundred billion dollars, I was a little shocked it wasn't higher. But here's the thing. So what Trump wants to do then is he wants to place a tariff on up to $60 billion worth of Chinese goods, I guess to pay for the damage done to the intellectual property rights of American corporations, I guess. And the reason I say that is, number one, I'm not so sure what the goods are. Looked briefly for a list of said goods that would be, and most of the mainstream press did not really get into it. And I read a handful of articles on this, and they just didn't get into it that deep. Maybe I need to actually go to the Department of Commerce, take a look at that. I'm sure they've got a list of these goods. But that's issue number one. Issue number two is this. We all understand what a tariff is, right? I mean, it's you got $60 billion worth of Chinese goods that annually come into the United States. Now we're going to attach a tariff to it. It's a tax. Let's say it's a 10% tax. That would be $6 billion. Who pays the $6 billion? The people that consume those Chinese goods. Is it going then directly from the consumer who pays the tax to everybody that was harmed by the Chinese stealing intellectual property? No, it goes to the U.S. federal government. Okay, but I'm sure you want to know if the U.S. government is then going to remunerate U.S. companies for having their intellectual property rights trampled on by the Chinese. Well, I can't find where that is the case. I think that I can't figure out what we're trying to do here. I really don't know what the end game is. We want to punish them, I guess. And the reason I say I guess there is that, when in announcing this, President Trump was very careful to say, look, we're friends with the Chinese. We have an ongoing dialogue about this, but we need to do this, I guess, to ward off any further attempts to steal U.S. intellectual property. So we're talking about a tariff on $60 billion worth of Chinese goods. Our trade deficit with them, depending on who you believe, is about $300 billion annually. So this is small. It's about 20% of the, not of the trade, not of imports, but of the difference between our imports of Chinese goods and Chinese imports of U.S. goods, the trade deficit. So it's about 20% of the trade deficit. This is not very big. So if we're trying to punish them, we would then have to ask, is a tax on $60 billion worth of annual goods going to in any way affect Chinese behavior regarding intellectual property in the United States? Color me dubious. I don't think that's going to be enough. So I'm not really sure what the goal here is. I assume it is punitive. We're just trying to punish them. But if you are trying to punish someone, you would think you would also have some a punishment that is heavy-handed enough to incentivize who you're punishing to not act the way they have. And that's not the case. The other problem I have with it is that if we're going to try to close trade deficits with people, something that admittedly I'm not in favor of, but if that is the, let's assume for a second that that should be the policy of the United States, then you have to recognize when you close that trade deficit, you're also closing the capital account surplus with them, which means they will no longer be able to fund our profligate spending. So in the same week that you have this directed tariff against China, ostensibly, again, because you want to close that trade deficit and you want to punish them for stealing intellectual property, you also announce a $1.3 trillion spending bill, which we're going to have to go into debt to fund. We are then going to punish the people that have traditionally paid for our debt, who have lent us the money. I don't really understand what is going on here. I understood, at least, I didn't necessarily agree with it, but I understood what the plan was with the steel and aluminum tariffs. You want to protect that industry here in the United States. That's simple to understand. This is not so simple to understand. But, I hope I'm being clear. I do think China steals U.S. intellectual property. And yes, they need to be brought to some kind of justice on that. I thought, though, that's what the World Trade Organization was for. If we've got all these problems with the way China trades with the United States, shouldn't we just admit that the World Trade Organization is a joke and stop funding it and stop sending people representatives there, stop being a part of it? I mean, this is the stuff the World Trade Organization, I thought, was supposed to address. But everybody seems to have a problem with trade with somebody. And I just, and I don't mean to say that the World Trade Organization does nothing. They do. But it seems like they don't do enough. And if they can't do enough because they don't have enough power, then they aren't very helpful or useful. So all of that stuff, Facebook, we can get into in the next segment, but all that stuff, that the spending bill, the tariffs, particularly the tariff, really rocked markets. And we talked at length over the past month or two about whether or not this was going to be a V-shaped recovery or if the market would come back and test the bottom. Well, we're testing the bottom. The hope that the Dow and the S&P 500 were going to have a V-shaped recovery is now dashed. The interesting thing is that the NASDAQ actually did have a V-shaped recovery. It exceeded the highs that it made earlier in the year. And now, shouldn't surprise you, it had a worse week than the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500. Most of that was Facebook and tariff-driven. We'll get into that in the next segment. You're listening to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust on KCMO Talk Radio 710 and 103.7 FM as well. Welcome back, Free Market Underground, where every week we talk about all things boom and bust. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. And Martell, always quick to react, playing a little Led Zeppelin, because that was basically the weight of the tariff on Thursday. It did not go over very well, went over like a Led Zeppelin. Wanted to make brief mention, if we can, about Facebook and tech in general. I think what's happening to Facebook is affecting the broad tech space for two reasons. Number one, you cannot forget that the NASDAQ is not equally weighted. Okay, if there are 1,000 stocks in the NASDAQ composite, they're not each the weighting they give to each of those 1,000 stocks is not the same. They do that by how big the presence in the stock market is. They call it market capitalization weighted index, which is what the value of the company is. The bigger values, the bigger companies, the companies with names that you know and use every day, for the most part, are the most heavily weighted on the NASDAQ. So when you see the NASDAQ go down, it would be weird that if Facebook went down by, say, 5% and the rest of the market, the rest of the stocks in the NASDAQ composite went up 1%, that you wouldn't be able to tell that, yeah, something is going down in that index because it's not up 1%. And it's usually Facebook and Amazon and Netflix. All these big companies are disproportionately weighted. So if there is a problem with one, there's a problem with the index. You get the same kind of problem with the Dow Jones. But that's not a market cap weighting, but it is not an even weighting. And the same is true of the S&P 500, but at least there's 500 stocks there. The Dow has 30, and actually the NASDAQ has a ton, but it is skewed very heavily towards the top 5, 6, 7 names. So that's one way. If Facebook has a problem because it gets so much weighting in the index, the whole index is going to have a problem. That's issue number one. Issue number two is exactly what went on. And that is that Facebook is being taken to task that it sold information about their users to another firm that then used it in the last election cycle. Now, that's a political story that you could spend a couple of days talking about, and certainly people have. But the point is, investment-wise with this, is that because Facebook is, I mean, as a business, what they are is advertising, we shouldn't have been surprised, number one. Number two, you got Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg both talking about, they're basically saying, bring on the regulation. We deserve it. And there are reasons why they might say that, too, by the way. It makes perfectly rational sense. But that whole idea that tech may be under attack by regulators, number one. Number two, by angry trading partners trying to retaliate against our tariffs is causing more havoc in the tech space than any other sector. And by the way, why would Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, who I think is the COO of Facebook, say bring on the regulation? Because regulation can be used to reduce or eliminate your competition. And in fact, it goes on in just about every regulated industry. These companies use regulation to make sure the hurdles for entry into their space is very high, or are very high, I should say. So that might be one of the reasons why they're not that distraught about being regulated. Is it the only reason? I have no idea. They're also, I know, left-leaning, Zuckerberg and Sandberg, so maybe they honestly do believe they deserve to be regulated and that everything will be peachy keen once they are. I don't know. But as far as the markets are concerned, that was just one of the stressors this week, which, by the way, was one of the worst weeks we've had year to date, which is young, admittedly. You're only about 3 months into this. I think this was the second worst week of the year, if I'm not mistaken. All right, what I want to do now is very briefly, and then we'll take a break, but I want to get into the economy and what's going on, because we spent a lot of time talking about how the economy is probably decelerating, probably has been decelerating now for a couple of months. And take a look at what was released this week and try to determine if we can sense anything decelerating. Most economic statistics are released on a monthly basis, and we're just looking at 1 week. So one quarter, roughly, of the monthly releases. And you look first at single-family home sales, and these actually rose quite a bit after taking kind of a beating the prior month. February is actually pretty good. So we're back on kind of an upward trajectory there, upward trend. Certainly that's not decelerating. Home price growth is nearing 8%. Actually, it hit 7.3% annual growth in home prices nationally. And, of course, all real estate is local, but 7.3% annually is pretty high. And, in fact, it's a 3.5-year high. Now, that might not be such good news for the broader economy, because ultimately you're keeping people from being able to afford to buy houses. But on the other hand, you've got people that have an asset that already own that can sell it for more than they could yesterday. So It's probably neither good nor bad unless it's a bubble, which necessitates some kind of crash in the future. I don't think it's out of bubble yet, but we're starting to get there. That's a very high growth rate, but it's certainly not decelerating. It's accelerating. We had solid growth for manufacturing in the what they call the PMI flash report, PMI, Purchasing Managers Index. They've got two of them, markets. They look at manufacturing and non-manufacturing, and it does look like non-manufacturing is decelerating with the latest numbers. And this is just a flash reading. It's conducted in the middle of the month. The final reading isn't going to be until the end of the month. The manufacturing PMI, though, came in at, right at a three-year high. So there's no decelerating there. But there is in the non-manufacturing space. So far, we've looked at three, four indicators. One of them looks like it's decelerating a little bit. The rest of them, no way. We'll get into the rest of them after we take a break, but we do have to take a break. I want to remind you that you can go to Free Market Underground's Facebook page, like us, follow us. We tend to update that twice a day with articles that I think are either interesting, enlightening, or have to do with free markets. Sometimes those articles have to do with what's going on in the markets, but usually it's about free markets. You might want to check that out, Free Market Underground's Facebook page. And also, freemarketunderground.com, got some charts posted for you there. Check them out. They're all relevant to what we're talking about today. Need to take a break? You're listening to Free Market Underground, KCMO Talk Radio, 710 AM and 103.7 FM. Welcome back to Free Market Underground, where every week we engage you in thoughtful discourse about our economy and our markets. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. Going to talk now a little bit more about our economy. We're trying to spot some deceleration and hoping, by the way, that we get a turnaround, go back to acceleration stage. The leading economic indicators that I usually talk about on this show are not these that I'm about ready to talk about. This is something else that was released this week, and this comes from the Conference Board. The Conference Board's Index of Leading Economic Indicators is advantageous in one sense in that it's not a black box. You know exactly how it's calculated and what they're looking at. On the other hand, though, to get historical data, you have to pay them. So it's not free. I usually talk about the ECRI's index, which is free. But I do follow this, too, the Conference Board's series. And they're not getting this leading economic indicator index isn't getting any help from the stock market or building permits. But it actually rose by 0.6% in February, and that is on top of a 0.8% jump in January. So this thing normally, on average, when it's growing, is going up by 0.1%, 0.2%, and 0.3% per month. You're looking at 0.6% and 0.8% over the last two. This is strong. And in fact, the Conference Board says that the leading economic index's trend is the best in 7 years, and that it points to robust economic growth throughout 2018. Well, this is one of the reasons why I think that if there is deceleration in the economy right now, that it's not likely to lead to a recession at any time soon. Now, everything like this can change rather quickly, but I do think that when you're looking at the strength in the leading economic indicators, both ECRI's, which is the Economic Cycle Research Institute, or Conference Board, they both look pretty strong. Even though they are decelerating on the ECRI index, They're not decelerating on the conference board series. So that's important. And I think it's probably the most important indicator that I saw this week, well, with the exception of one, which we'll get to in a second. Also, Kansas City Fed released its regional manufacturing survey. And if you look at all the regional manufacturing surveys from all the Fed districts, there's the Empire State in New York. There's the Philly Fed survey in the Philadelphia district, Fed district, Richmond, Virginia, Dallas. All of these seem to be, well, actually, there's no trend. Some of them are pretty strong. Some of them are weakening. Kansas City's right in the middle. The Kansas City Fed, the composite index, this number shouldn't mean anything to you necessarily, but it's right where it was last month at 17. 17 is actually kind of strong. It just didn't move, but 17 is strong. So it went from strong to strong. Not a change, and that's not bad. But if you look at the details, it actually looks like we could be looking at supply chain difficulties, potential stresses on capacity in that manufacturing space here at home. And what that means really is inflation. And that is kind of what the Fed is concerned about. It's what I think everybody's at least aware of and concerned about. So it really looks like right now all of the inflation is kind of centered in manufacturing. It looks like demand has outstripped not only supply, but our ability to generate more supply. So that could lead to higher prices. It's certainly going to lead to higher prices in the manufacturing space, but will it be passed on to consumers? We don't know. But certainly it will first reflect prices in the manufacturing space, which crimps profits. Now, I said that probably the most important indicator was that leading economic index. And by the way, we should conclude with Kansas City. That's not decelerating. The headline number might not have changed, but it's certainly not decelerating. So we move on to durable goods, new orders. Now, there's a part of that. If you've listened to the show for a while, there's one particular metric in there that I look for, and it's what they call core capital goods. That's non-defense, ex-aircraft, durable goods. Goods that make other goods as a capital good. Those surged 1.8%. We got this information on Friday morning, by the way, for the month of February. That core capital goods, non-defense ex-aircraft, that is an official leading economic indicator used by the conference board. That was up 1.8% on the month, which is basically beyond even the highest estimate for the month. Shipments of these capital goods, core capital goods, jumped 1.4%, and that's probably going to positively impact first quarter GDP, which we will get the first hint of in late April. So there is no deceleration there either. Bottom line, there is still deceleration, but the stuff that we looked at this week, no, we're not seeing it. We're not seeing the issue with deceleration, and that's actually good because new home sales was one of the things that gave me concern last month, and this seems to have reversed that trend a little bit. I don't know how sustainable that is because mortgage rates have gone, you know, parabolic, making it even more difficult. Now that prices are growing on homes, are growing at, you know, 5-7% per year, and you're making it more unaffordable with a really high mortgage on top of it, how long do you think the boom in home sales is going to last? My estimate would be not long. All right, I want to talk about something else going on in the markets that I think has flown under the radar for the most part, but I actually started to see it be covered in some not-so-esoteric corners of the financial world, CNBC, Bloomberg, Everybody seems to have noticed this. And what I'm talking about is the difference between LIBOR interest rates and what they call the overnight indexed swap rate, which means nothing to you, shouldn't mean anything to you. But that is this difference in interest rates. By the way, difference in interest rates, and you can do this infinite number of ways, always yield useful information. Now, you might not know how useful it is, but it is always useful. When we've talked about the yield curve before, when you're looking at the difference, the spread between long-term bond interest rates and short-term bond interest rates, that should tell you about whether the Fed is tightening or if they are loosening monetary conditions. In other words, is it a good time to be in stocks or not? The difference between junk bond yields and the yield on the 10-year U.S. government treasury, risky versus not so risky, that yields information. What does that tell you? Tells you if there's any kind of credit crisis on the horizon. So you can always get something out of these spreads. In this particular spread, which I will call the LIBOR OIS spread, I've got some charts posted at freemarketunderground.com that'll show this, but literally it has gone parabolic. And usually when this goes parabolic, it means that something ain't cool in the global financial system. It's kind of like a thermometer that detects illness or fever in the global financial system. And it's starting, I think, to wreak some havoc on corporate bonds. And by the way, I should probably explain that LIBOR, which stands for the London Interbank Offer Rate, is just an interest rate that banks charge each other for short-term unsecured loans. Okay, and so LIBOR has some credit risk in it. And when LIBOR goes up, sometimes that means I don't want to lend you money because I don't know that you're going to be around to pay me back. Okay, so but it's also there's an interest rate component in there as well. And if you look at a chart of LIBOR, it is going straight north. And so the spread between LIBOR and OIS is because LIBOR is going up, not OIS. And that is because, we'll get into that in a second, but the bottom line is with LIBOR, so much corporate debt, so much international debt is priced in terms of, say, LIBOR plus 2%. So whatever LIBOR is, which fluctuates, plus 2%, that's what I owe you in the coming year if I have borrowed money from you. So LIBOR is kind of like this benchmark that is allowed to vary. And so if I'm a pretty good credit risk, I might be able to get a loan for 1% plus LIBOR. If I'm a really bad credit risk, my loan might be 5% plus LIBOR. So that's the way it's used. So when LIBOR is screaming north, as it is, there is a legitimate concern that we should expect some defaults, some bankruptcies, because it's making debt more expensive for borrowers. So that's issue number one, but that's not the real issue with this spread. This spread, because LIBOR has some credit risk in it, and the OIS is just a measure of interest rates. When you strip OIS out of LIBOR, what you're left with is credit risk. And so it's a pretty good, that spread is a pretty good indicator of credit crises, as is the TED spread, which we'll talk about later. But this is absolutely screaming north. And we're going to talk about why it's screaming north and whether we ought to be concerned about it. Now that it's starting to make mainstream press, maybe it's a good time to actually address it. We need to take a break. When we get back, we'll continue our discussion and we'll talk about markets. You're listening to Free Market Underground, KCMO Talk Radio 710, now heard on 103.7 FM as well. Welcome back to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust, where every week we try to make a little bit of sense out of our world. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. In the last segment, we broached the idea of the spread between LIBOR and OIS as an indicator of financial system stress globally. And that's what it indicates, and it is going up in a dramatic way. I've got a chart posted at freemarketunderground.com. So why is this thing going up? Remember, we've stripped out the interest rate from it, so all we're left with is a measure of credit risk. This spread is regarded really as a measure of how expensive or cheap it'll be for banks to borrow. And right now, I think you have to say that it's going to be kind of expensive for banks to borrow. And this is not even including whatever interest rate pressures there might be as well, because we've stripped all of the interest rate element out of it. So should we be worried at all? Well, the LIBOR rate for three-month loans in dollars has climbed to 2.2%, and that's a level it hasn't seen since 2008. LIBOR for a lot of the recovery was less than 1%. So this spread widened mainly once Congress started a deal on the U.S. budget and debt ceiling on February 8th, and that gap between these two rates widened from 0.25% at the end of January to around 0.5% in the middle of March. It last closed higher than that in 2009. But it's the speed with which this is going up that is causing investors some degree of pause. So there are a lot of factors that are at work here. One has to do with the fact that we were having to issue, and once we came to that that budget deal, we couldn't spend prior to it. Then we could. We started issuing a nonstop torrent of Treasury bill debt, and that supply has unleashed this wave of, well, look at it, it's just like supply and demand on anything. If you increase the number of Treasury bills out there, what happens to the price of those bills? It goes down. And when a bond price goes down, the interest rate does what? It goes up. So you increase the Treasury bill supply, you increase your debt, and that's what's really that's what I think is really driving this, is the torrent of debt we've had to auction off here to catch up from a couple of months and not spending. Also, the tax bill signed into law in December, late December, I think it was the 22nd, has, I guess it's led to an increased incentive for corporations to bring some of their money back to the U.S. that had previously been stashed overseas. That's tended to be kept in short-term instruments like commercial paper and similar short-term vehicles overseas. So when you take that money, you move it to the United States, you're selling those things, which again is like a bond. The price goes down, interest rates go up. And then you've got the Federal Reserve shrinking its $4.5 trillion balance sheet. They're selling bonds back into the market, increasing the supply. Again, all of this affects LIBOR, and LIBOR is soaring, and that's the source of the difference in that spread, LIBOR OIS. So the bottom line is, do we need to be freaked out about this? If it keeps going up, the answer is yes. But there's at least a decent chance that it's not going to, and here's why. we'll have to see here after the Fed hiked rates on Wednesday, something we haven't even had a chance really to talk about. But they did hike rates on Wednesday. That should relieve some of the pressure here. We'll see if that's the case. But when I first saw this spread growing like it has been, I've been looking at the Chicago Fed's Financial Conditions Index to see if there is a similar reading of stress from it. There isn't. And it's also worth mentioning that this same spread in other currencies, euro, yen, for example, is not as problematic. And in fact, doesn't look anything like what we're seeing here in the United States. So right now, this is simply a dollar issue. And that means there is probably not a lot of stress globally. That's a good thing. And I think we would know anyway without having to resort to some kind of esoteric spread if we thought there were some stresses in the banking system here in the United States. I heard one trader say, look, liquidity in the banking space is still good. It's just that liquidity is costing people a lot more money to access. And that's probably the best way to look at it. If you look at the stock market this week, obviously it had a problem, and it mainly had a problem with the tariffs. But if you look even beyond that, the market doesn't care about this tariff with China. It really doesn't, because it's so small. And the retaliation that's been planned, also small. In fact, part of that retaliation by the Chinese was measured in millions of dollars. You know, we're talking about billions here. We're talking about $300 billion of trade deficit. We're talking about $500, $600 billion worth of commerce between these two countries. So far, they don't really care about that. What they care about is escalation. And that's what traders are looking at. Is this going to get ugly? Is it going to get nasty? Are we all going to have to go on Google and search for Smoot-Hawley and see how that worked out? That's what traders want to know. It's what investors want to know. Is this going to get as ugly as Smoot-Hawley in 1929? Which, by the way, was interesting because as that bill gained support in the Senate, every account coming out in the financial press that suggested more and more senators were backing it, you did actually see the stock market sell off. And so I do think there is something credible to the notion that Smoot-Hawley, a tariff, a gargantuan tariff act in 1929, had a lot to do with the stock market tanking. It might have been the match that lit the oily pile of rags, but of course the Federal Reserve created the oily pile of rags and put a book of matches right next to it. So there's a lot of blame to go on there, but clearly markets do not like tariffs. And what we're talking about right now, again, not much of a tariff. But the fear is that this is just the beginning. We'll see. And I really don't know how much the market can handle of tariff uncertainty or non-clarity. We'll see. I think they want a resolution to this thing, and they want it pretty bad. It's all the time we have for today, but we will be back next week to analyze the economy and the markets that comprise it. Stay tuned, if you will, for Don Wales, Protecting Your Retirement. That comes up next. This show is sponsored by Butler Lands and Wagler. I want to thank Martell Love for producing, and I want to thank you for listening to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust. Until next Saturday, have a great week.